to be able to stage something up here typically takes days.
A look at search and rescue needs as shipping traffic increases in the Arctic. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, February 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, debate over a Board of Fisheries proposal that could limit a Gulf of Alaska salmon fishery.
It sounds like hyperbole, but when the stocks are on the ropes, every fish does count a heck of a lot more.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Driving conditions are challenging this evening in south-central Alaska, including on the Glenn Highway, which connects thousands of commuters between Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. Drivers were stuck for about 2 hours earlier today north of Anchorage after police shut down the highway to deal with multiple accidents. Anchorage police said there were several collisions involving a total of roughly 17 vehicles. No major injuries were reported, though. Shortly after noon, police announced the highway had reopened, but cautioned drivers to expect delays with 2 out of 4 lanes closed. The National Weather Service warned that areas of dense fog and hazardous conditions would likely persist through the evening commute. The Alaska Senate Finance Committee is instituting a voluntary COVID-19 testing policy after several legislators and staff have tested positive for the virus. The Alaska Beacon reports that Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman said that with all three committee co-chairs, including himself, calling for voluntary testing, in Stedman's words, it's voluntary in the same sense of an Army sergeant asking for volunteers. Elsewhere, the chairs of the House and Senate Rules Committees issued a joint memo calling on legislators and staff to stay home if they are ill or test positive for COVID-19. At least 2 members of the state House have been ill with COVID and away from the Capitol this week, including Representative Stanley Wright of Anchorage and Representative George Rauscher of Sutton. Besides voluntary testing, so far there have been no changes in the Capitol's COVID policy. More ships than ever are traveling through the Arctic Ocean. That's because a warming climate is making the region increasingly navigable. But more access could mean more accidents. And in this final segment in an ongoing series, Emily Schwing looks at search and rescue response along America's northernmost coastline.
Most evenings, Joe Levitt can be found passing the time with a deck of cards at the Barrow Volunteer Search and Rescue Base in Utqiagvik.
What are you playing here, Joe?
Solitary. Once in a great while, we'll have a pinnacle game.
Levitt is also a whaling crew captain. In Utqiagvik, the region's rich whaling culture is on full display. Most people walk around town wearing jackets emblazoned with the name and flag of their whaling crew. Levitt says whaling seasons and search and rescue are the two things that bring the whole community out. And whether you're searching for a whale or someone who's lost in a boat or on a snow machine, Levitt says you don't stop looking.
We had how many incidents that people went into their, people walk home and they thought they were dead and they actually went to their own memorial service. People have done that up here.
No way.
Yeah, they did.
Levitt knows all too well how quickly things can go from good to dangerous.
Oh yeah, on a boat. I was rescued last summer. My boat broke down and they actually went and retrieved my boat for me and help me get home.
Tell me more.
And it's a good thing because when we're doing our hunting, we don't really have to pay for the rescue.
But that could change because according to the Arctic Council, all marine traffic increased by 44% through the Northwest Passage between 2013 and 2019. That means more boats, which could mean more rescues.
Maybe if a lot of people come up here and change everything, we'll start paying for our rescues, you know, your own rescue.
So, I mean, we got four-wheelers side-by-side. We have more of them coming in, two more side-by-sides. We're going to have the track.
Curtis Lehman is the base mechanic, one of its few paid employees. They have two boats, both decades old, and one of them was out of commission last year, waiting on a new motor. A snow machine parked nearby is one Lehman might use for parts in the future.
It looks like you're working on this one.
Yeah, this one is, I mean, the Skidoos need a computer all the time when any kind of glitches go on.
So. In January, he went at least 2 weeks without a paycheck.
It sounds like funding is the biggest thing.
It is.
That you need. It's just like a constant influx.
Resource of money coming in, correct. That is our hindrance. We barely get by with some of the maintenance that we do. It took us a year and a half to get our new motors for this boat.
The volunteer base operates on a shoestring budget, raising money through pull tab sales and working with the tribal government and the North Slope Borough to fill gaps. The borough also operates a search and rescue program. At roughly $14 million, its annual budget is more robust. The program's key assets, two airplanes and two helicopters, are housed in a giant hangar alongside Utqiagvik's runway. Josh Greer is the chief pilot. He says the North Slope is on its own.
To be able to stage something up here typically takes days to be able to get, a Coast Guard asset or a National Guard asset, 24 hours, probably at the very bare minimum, sometimes longer.
The closest U.S. Coast Guard base is roughly 940 miles due south of Utqiagvik. By sea, that distance more than doubles. Last October, a Coast Guard helicopter hoisted a crew member off a Canadian icebreaker 200 miles northeast of Utqiagvik. The medevac was successful with help from the borough, but Greer says they wouldn't have been able to do it alone.
We have hoist capabilities, but we are not capable. It takes a pretty big training program. It would take additional personnel, and it would take a lot of resources to make a much larger budget.
That partnership with the Coast Guard? Experts say that's what has to happen for search and rescue in this region. In 2017, a graduate student in California wrote a dissertation on search and rescue preparedness in Alaska's Arctic and found that no single organization has enough resources. But when they cooperate, the military, the volunteers, the borough, that study says they are formidable.
We help each other. Okay. Everybody, no matter who you are, because, you know, it's so harsh living in Barrow, this cold, dark, and if the neighbor needs help, we're going to help him.
That's Tony Ockpick. He just stopped by the volunteer base to say hello.
It takes the community to pull up the whale, and we pull up 20 whales, 30 whales a year, and it takes the whole community to do that, and so we just keep it in that way, see?
Last fall, the Coast Guard, emergency response in Utqiagvik, including search and rescue, and even the local hospital held a tabletop scenario in which dozens of cruise ship passengers needed help. The goal? To figure out where resources are lacking and how to meet the growing need. In Utqiagvik, I'm Emily Schwing.
This ongoing series is made possible through a grant from the Climate Justice Resilience Fund. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the life of Elizabeth Kudrin, the great survivor.
The matriarch of matriarchs. The last mom from Attu.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, delivering digital banking options at your fingertips. First National Bank Alaska, 100 years shaping tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
In April, the State Division of Public Assistance will begin the year-long process of reviewing every Medicaid recipient in the state. All 263,000 Alaskans who receive Medicaid have been guaranteed coverage over the last 3 years of the statewide COVID-19 public health emergency, and now the division has to resume its usual checks to make sure people still qualify, all while it manages a backlog of food stamps and other public assistance applications. Alaska turned in a plan to the federal government for how it will wind down from the public health emergency, but it is one of only 9 states without a publicly posted plan. Deb Etheridge is the director of the Division of Public Assistance. She took over leadership of the division last month in the midst of the backlog, and she says the state does not want anyone to lose health coverage.
And for the individuals who will be transitioning off of our state Medicaid program, we're working with the federal marketplace with the Division of Insurance to ensure that they have options for health insurance.
Most of the recertification work falls to the eligibility staff who determine if individuals still qualify for federal assistance. But there is something Alaskans can do to prepare, and that's to make sure their addresses are up to date with the state. Notifications about when and how to reapply for Medicaid will arrive by mail, and Etheridge says checking and reading the mail will help speed the process. Updating an address does require a call to the division's virtual contact center, though, and that has frustrated public assistance recipients with long wait times over the past few months. Etheridge says the division will be training 75 new contract workers to answer the phones in the coming weeks, which should significantly lessen wait times. Jared Kosin, the president of the state's Hospital and Nursing Association, calls it a major insurance event. He says people tend to fall off the Medicaid rolls when there's a change that requires action from the consumer.
Outreach and kind of methodical planning and execution are going to be really important because it can be really disruptive to have a lot of people drop off of Medicaid.
Officials say some reapplications will be processed automatically, but others will need to be done manually by the same eligibility workers that are processing a months-long backlog of food stamps. There's a key difference, though, with the food stamp applications. People stopped getting food stamps with that backlog, and Etheridge says that won't happen with Medicaid recertifications. Alaskans who no longer qualify for care will have 30 to 60 days for appeals. The department has not yet released a public plan for what will happen after that. A new VA clinic opened in Fairbanks today with a ribbon-cutting ceremony, while in Anchorage, the VA Medical Center was officially renamed after Colonel Mary Louise Rasmussen. Rasmussen was one of the first members of the Women's Army Corps and rose through the ranks to become its leader. She married Anchorage banker Elmer Rasmussen in 1961 and moved to Alaska, where she was a supporter of the arts and countless civic organizations. University of Alaska Anchorage professor Vanessa Mead spoke at the dedication ceremony in the Anchorage clinic's lobby. She recalled meeting Rasmussen in 2012, a few months before her death.
At her home when we met her, she was 101 years old, completely dressed to the nines, hair perfect, just sitting there with such dignity.
Mead says Rasmussen helped integrate Black women into the Women's Army Corps and women into the regular Army decades later.
When I asked her what was the best part about her service, she said, "Why, being the boss, of course," and laughed.
U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she hopes having one of the few VA facilities in the country that's named for a woman will give Alaska's female veterans a greater sense of belonging. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation were on hand for the naming ceremony, as was U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Secretary Dennis McDonough. McDonough also visited Bethel Thursday and spoke to more than a dozen veterans at the local VFW post.
One of the reasons I thought it was important to come to Alaska was to see the way we work as closely as we do with the state of Alaska and with the tribes to provide care in these forward deployed settings.
McDonough and Congresswoman Mary Peltola met personally with each veteran present and fielded questions for almost 2 hours. At this week's Board of Fisheries meeting, a controversial Alaska Peninsula salmon fishery is at the center of a debate on how to protect the record-low Yukon River chum salmon runs. KDLG's Izzy Ross reports.
The Area M fishery around the Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian Islands is a mixed stock fishery targeting salmon far from their home rivers. The proposal would reduce commercial fishing time there in an attempt to let more chum salmon return to western Alaska spawning grounds. Some of the testimony at the Board of Fisheries meeting was emotional. Michelle Quillen of Hughes says they can't rely on commercial industry to regulate itself. She called the decline in salmon runs on the Yukon cultural genocide of Alaska Native people.
A lot of change needs to happen, but here we only ask that you pass Prop 140 and limit the time Area M has their gear in the water. because that is the only thing that will work.
Area M has become a focal point in an increasingly urgent debate around how to address declining salmon returns to rivers across western Alaska. This proposal would resurrect a management plan that was in place in the early 2000s, restricting fishing time in a June fishery that also makes up a significant chunk of Area M's monetary value. Fisheries biologist Daniel Schindler says the proposal is reasonable because it provides windows of time for fish to swim through without being caught. He says that the state's most recent genetic study shows Area M is harvesting around 5% of the chum swimming to western Alaska rivers. That may not seem like a lot, but it could make a big difference for weak runs.
It sounds like hyperbole, but when the stocks are on the ropes, every fish does count a heck of a lot more than it does when the populations are at high abundance. In the case of AYK chum stocks right now, it's very obvious to everyone in this room that those stocks are at very depressed abundances.
Meanwhile, people along the Yukon River haven't been able to subsistence fish for chum for years. They also say any additional conservation efforts will help. Many who support the proposal say they haven't been able to get enough fish to feed their communities or pass down traditions. Teresa Clark is a Loudoun tribal member and works for the Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council. She says their subsistence needs are not being met, and smokehouses have been empty for years.
We cannot teach our youth to preserve salmon anymore, as we cannot fish for salmon. Our fish camps are not being used, as we have not fished.
Climate change is also a focus. At the start of the meeting, state ecologist Katie Howard presented data on how recent chum crashes correlate with warming waters in the Bering Sea and North Pacific. Howard says the fish were not getting enough nutrients because their primary food sources had declined.
They were experiencing extraordinary heat waves during their first summer at sea, so in these regions, and those that survived to winter then were hit with a heat wave in the North Pacific Ocean, so they just couldn't escape it during their first year at sea.
Some Area M fishermen say reducing fishing time won't significantly help chum salmon runs, and ask the board to maintain the status quo. Commercial fisherman Jared Danielson says the proposal to cut Area M fishing time would harm them more than it would help the chum runs.
The low harvest rates in Area M are of low significance to the AYK chum salmon swimming through the Gulf of Alaska. The evidence by Fish and Game earlier in this meeting points to our ocean being on empty, not Area M.
The Board of Fish meeting was originally set to end on Saturday, but will likely run 2 days longer than scheduled. The board will have to decide on this and other proposals before the end of the meeting. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
The University of Alaska is tapping outgoing Juneau School District Superintendent Bridget Weiss to help build the state's teacher workforce. At the Liaison for the Alaska College of Education Consortium, Weiss will help the university partner with school districts, state government, and other stakeholders. One of her goals is to increase the number of students dual enrolled in high school and college classes, especially those pursuing teaching degrees.
When high school students earn college credit in our system, that is a big head start for them and more likely that they will become full-time students in our state university system. And when we produce teachers in our state system, they're very likely to stay in the state.
At a presentation to the State Senate Education Committee this week, University of Alaska President Pat Pitney said she wants to see more alumni teaching in the state.
We have capacity in our education programs
We need more students.
The university already has several strategies to recruit teachers within Alaska, including a mentorship program to support early career teachers. But Pitney says those can only do so much without help from the state in the form of K-12 education funding and changes to the state's public employee retirement system. Weiss says advocating for state policy will be an important part of her new job.
If we don't have the real foundational core of a defined benefit retirement and adequate funding, it's going to be much harder to entice kids into this field.
Weiss announced her departure from the superintendent position in October. She'll stay through the end of the school year and remain in Juneau for her new job, which starts July 1st. A part of Alaska history passed this week along with Elizabeth Kudrin, who was remembered by family and friends as a great survivor. But few Alaskans know her story, and even fewer Americans. Kudrin was one of two remaining survivors from Attu, a remote Aleutian island captured by Japanese soldiers during World War II. Kudrin was just a baby when she and the rest of her village were taken to Japan as prisoners of war. KNBA's Rhonda McBride has this look at Kudrin's life and legacy.
About 40 people from Attu were sent to Otaru, Hokkaido, where they were housed in a big, shabby building. About half of them died before the end of World War II, including Elizabeth Kudrin's father. Her husband, George, says Elizabeth's death marks the end of an era.
The matriarch of matriarchs, the last mom from Attu.
George Kudrin says his wife never talked about the war. It was just too painful. In his book, Attu Boy, Elizabeth's late brother, Nick Golodoff, described the hunger and starvation in Japan and how, by the end of the war, their daily ration was only a quarter of a bowl of watered-down rice. Rachel Mason, a National Park Service historian, says the people of Attu were taken to Japan in the month of September, just after the summer fishing season, timing that turned out to be key to their survival.
The Japanese told the Attuans to pack as much as they could of their subsistence foods, and so they brought dried fish, and that, I think, saved them, because at least until their fish ran out, they ate fairly well in Japan.
The Attuans who did survive were never allowed to return home to their island, which remains uninhabited today. The federal government resettled Elizabeth Kudrin's family in the neighboring island of Atka. Her husband, George, says the Atkins were puzzled to hear their newly arrived four-year-old sing in a mysterious language.
She used to sing in Japanese. She would go under the table and sing Japanese, so she doesn't remember that, though.
Although his wife kept mostly silent about the trauma her family experienced in the war, George Kudrin says he knew she was haunted by the experience, and yet marveled at how she always found a way to be kind and compassionate to others. He sums up his wife's legacy in two words in Unangam Tenu, Elizabeth's first language.
Ayagam Kayutu, strong woman. And she just loved you.
Elizabeth Kudrin, known as simply Liz to friends and loved ones, was born in 1941, the same year Japanese fighter planes bombed Pearl Harbor. She died just a few days after her 82nd birthday on Sunday, February 19th. Her brother George Goldoff is now the last remaining survivor of Attu. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Today marked the start of one of the most iconic events in the Fur Rondi Festival in Anchorage, the World Championship Sled Dog Races. The three-day sprint mushing event brought veterans and rookies alike all competing for glory and prize money in front of a crowd. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
Andy Hooten was the first musher out of the shoot at noon Friday as hundreds gathered in downtown Anchorage to watch the Open World Championship sled dog races. Dogs whined, barked, bounded, and sprinted across the snow as 17 teams took off every 90 seconds. In front of the Ferrandi headquarters on 4th Avenue and D Street, race official Rick Cavins watched each team go by as the race's Avenue Ambassador, a job he describes as
glorified parking attendant and crowd control.
Mushers will race 3 days in a row, competing for the fastest overall time for a $55,000 purse. Caven says they'll run the same 26-mile loop each day. They'll head out on city bike trails before passing through Bicentennial Park and looping back to the start as they hit the Campbell Park airstrip. Cavins, a veteran musher himself, says as they come back, mushers could end up facing each other down on the trail.
You can have head-ons, which can be a little stimulating when you have 16 or more dogs.
Though competition is certainly fierce with 14 veterans joining three rookies on the trail, Cavins says there's a lot of camaraderie. As crowds cheered on their favorite mushers, Cavins beamed. He says the Ferrandi sprint races predate the Iditarod, and at a time, it was the premier sled dog event in the state.
It's a sport born out of working class dogs, ordinary people. And these are ordinary men and women racing these dogs and raising them and just trying to put a little extra spin. You walk up to another guy's truck and go, I think I can do that better.
Caven sees the Ferrandi as a family affair. He mushed dogs for 23 years and all four of his kids race teams as well. As he watches the crowd, his wife is timing the mushers.
These are our friends. We love them. We're going to support them in their endeavors, even though we've already picked up our lifetime quota of dog poop.
At the end of the first day's heat, Blaine Streeper had the fastest loop time with Gary Markley in second and Michael Tetzner in third. The last musher to leave the chute today will lead the pack on Saturday. That'll be Hugh Neff, a rookie to the Ferrandi Sprints, but a longtime Iditarod competitor who was denied entry to the 1,000-mile race this year. Mushers will take off on the third and final loop on Sunday. The Ferrandi fun doesn't stop there, with a carnival, parade, and other festivities keeping downtown Anchorage buzzing all weekend. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. And wherever you get your podcasts, of course, and that includes on Spotify. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea, Liz Ruskin, Wesley Early, and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Utqiagvik, Claire Strempel and Katie Anastas in Juneau, Francisco Martinez Cuello in Bethel, and Izzy Ross in Dillingham. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.